no parent's going to give up on their child unless they know for certain a child's dead, and that we just don't have any evidence. So
my
hope of
Madeline being out there is no less than it was almost 10 years ago. I mean, apart from those first 48 hours, nothing actually has changed since then. I mean, I think the difficult thing has always been, how will we find her? You know, because you're relying on the police doing everything they can, and you're relying on somebody with information coming forward.
According to the McCanns and their friends, every half an hour or so, somebody from the group was going to check on their own children. Yeah. Now, the McCanns' children were all in the same room, which was the front bedroom of the apartment.
The patio doors here were left shut but unlocked. And then there's a journey through here to the children's bedrooms. You'll see Madeline was in this bed here, the twins in the cots in the middle. And the important thing there is that Kate McCann says that when she came up to look, that this door, which had been left just ajar, was wide open.
Yes, it was 10 p.m. when Kate made that final journey back to the apartment. It was her turn to go and check on the kids. Crucially, there was no sign of Madeline.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and writer-producer for CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former head of the Homicide Prevention Unit at New Scotland Yard and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I am Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds. I have a real interest in real crime and these minds that solve these crimes.
So we are deep diving, and we're continuing to deep dive the disappearance of Madeline McCann, who disappeared just 1 week short of her fourth birthday in Portugal on May the 3rd, 2007.
And we're just going to jump right back into our conversation.
But I will say that for me, the Netflix show offered no analysis, really. And to have two journalists kind of talking it through, yes, it was helpful, but it didn't really get into a deep dive offering statistics and any real insight. It just presented things. So, of course, there's the Maddie podcast, which a lot of our listeners have been listening to, and that almost is the antidote to the Netflix documentary. If you listen to the two together, you wouldn't think they're talking about the same case.
Right. But I will say, though, I was not pleased when I heard some of the people that that are touted as experts in the Maddie podcast, particularly Pat Brown. Pat Brown is a self-appointed criminal profiler. Pat Brown has a degree in criminal justice, but she did not ever work for law enforcement. And I don't trust her analysis because she never actually worked cases. She claims on her site to have assisted or consulted with law enforcement in a number of cases, and that may be the case, but I don't know any way that she has credibility as a profiler. She did not work for the FBI. She did not work for New Scotland Yard. She did not have the level of training that we've had, and she nowhere even espouses that. She basically read a lot of books. But as you and I know, Laura, it's not book learning that makes you a good profiler. It's not book learning that makes you a good forensic behavioral analyst. It is actually working the cases and seeing the nuances and living, experiencing those things, educating your gut so that it can tell you. Your subconscious can actually crunch all the data and actually tell you what the more high probability events are and what really happened in a particular case. So it really undermined my entire view of that podcast when he claimed that Pat Brown was a criminal behavioral profiler expert. And then aren't there other experts, and I'm using the air quotes, that they've referenced that you know or don't know about?
Yes, I mean, there are people on there that are touted as top detectives and solving crimes. But what I will say about one of those individuals is he had a very good team that worked incredibly hard on two high profile operations. And that resulted in serial offenders. One of them was a serial rapist and one of them was a serial killer being brought to justice over time. And I worked on both those cases, and the teams worked incredibly hard. And as you know, Jim, it's never down to one person. It's down to a team effort. But of course, those who seek the glory then get touted as being the top detective. So, yes, I do have question marks about some of the things that are said by some of those individuals. And I guess it always plays into, and it was, you know, who you use and who your experts are. For one expert, you'll find another. But looking at credentials and knowing where someone comes from, you know, Mark saw Knocker Knocker, you know, he said because Pat Brown had no background at New Scotland Yard or the FBI, then she doesn't have any alliance or allegiances. But
no, that's bullshit. That's bullshit. I'm sorry. I'm just calling what it is. You know, that doesn't help. And that's what I'm talking about this podcast. I think Maddie podcast has this overwhelming conspiratorial anti-government, anti-law enforcement, anti-anything that they can't get their hands on. And that, to me, is it starts with a bias, an uncurable bias. And if he had actually gone to the experts, if he had reached out to Kathy Canning, for example, who doesn't have a stake in the Madeleine McCann case, she was asked to actually go and review the evidence and do a formal criminal behavioral analysis of the case. And she is incredibly gifted at working these cases. She is the one, for example, who did the false allegations of child abduction study. And if anything, he should go to people like that who actually spent their careers and published work that is touted worldwide as comprehensive and beyond reproach. Those people, they're not going to step outside just because they're not influenced at all by British politics or Portuguese politics. That has nothing to do with how Kathy would analyze this case. And I wish he had gone to her or to me or to somebody else from the Crimes Against Children Unit in the BAU or to somebody in Scotland Yard that actually works child abduction cases, because they would be on the cutting edge of the information. And other things, you know, he's talking about DNA and he brings a guy on to say that, well, you know, transfer DNA or touch DNA really isn't an issue in most cases. I haven't seen it become an issue. And
I know.
In 1984?
Yeah.
I mean, it, you know.
But you didn't find Dr. Perlin. You didn't find Dr. Perlin.
It wasn't Dr. Perlin who made that statement.
Okay. Sorry.
No, it was an investigator. Dr. Perlin is a scientist, not an investigator. But the investigator, the very experienced investigator, he may be very experienced, but he's not experienced in the area of DNA. Because I'll tell you right now, the collection methodologies that are in place today, and even in place at the time that Madeleine McCann went missing, can produce touch DNA or transfer DNA samples that are not very bountiful. They're small, tiny, little, minute samples, but it can create a lot of questions, because they're typically mixed samples, because that resort was a place that hundreds, if not thousands, of people had lived, all right, over time. And DNA in the form of skin cells and hair and spit and any kind of biological fluids can remain there for many, 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 many months and years. Now, the particular locations where they found the DNA, behind a couch, that's a place where people don't necessarily pull it away and back you behind. So things like that could be left behind for years. And that's why they collected, quote, DNA. But there's no indication of what the source of that DNA is. There's no indication that it's actually blood. And there's no indication that it's other bodily fluids that could be identified. For example, very relevant DNA in a rape case is sperm that is left behind. If you can get the DNA from sperm from a rape kit, that's a very high probability that you have identified the actual rapist. But if you get transfer DNA from a chair or a sofa or behind a couch or on a wall or in a closet from a place that thousands of people have gone to, including Maddie living there, to find her DNA there is absolutely predictable and absolutely irrelevant in terms of her missing nature. Or her potential abduction. You would have to have copious amounts of blood and her DNA found in that blood for it to be relevant in terms of potentially her dying in that place. But it is also very possible when we talk about the cadaver dog hitting on the closet or a particular area, we know that Madeline's favorite toy, her little stuffed animal, was on the bed where she was sleeping when she was reportedly last seen in that apartment. It is possible, as Laura pointed out, the previous people who went to check on Maddie and the kids didn't actually see Maddie and the kids. So we don't know what time, if there was an intruder, the intruder got in, or if Maddie died, what time Maddie died. It's possible that Maddie was killed in that apartment by an intruder. It's possible. And if so, if her stuffed animal was right there with her, in contact with her, that could take the scent of a body with it.
That quickly? So then, I mean,
It depends on the temperature. It depends on basically what it had contact with. The body starts to decay as soon as it dies. Actually, we decay all the time. Our skin cells do it all the time. And every cell inside of our body goes through the same metamorphosis. It's just not replenished when you pass away. So it would probably take some time. And I'm talking about a very small possibility, but and I'm not even calling it a probability, but there are reasons why a cadaver dog could hit on that apartment. Even if Maddie was killed by somebody, a stranger, and then bought out of the apartment dead, which is a possibility. Again, I don't know what would motivate that. It would be a very sick individual who would probably have a history of fantasizing and doing other kind of nuisance crimes like peeping and breaking into homes and breaking into these kinds of apartments and resorts. That would be the kind of person I would be looking for. But I have no idea what the actual timeline is because law enforcement did not nail it down immediately, because the people who we got it from all conspired together. And I don't mean that in a criminal way, but all got together and discussed it and then came up with the timeline, which they very quickly, within 24 hours, revised. And that could be because they remembered more. That could be because they were trying to put a better spin on it. I do believe that the McCanns and the other top of seven do feel some degree of responsibility for leaving their kids at risk, even though it may have been safe. And probably thousands and thousands of people have done this over and over again without incident. In this case, there was an incident. And whether that incident was somebody coming in or somebody accidentally, for example, people have talked about possibly the doctors medicating their kids to keep them asleep. So that's kind of a medical babysitter so that they can go out and have fun and the kids are just home sleeping. If that's something that happened and then they passed away as a result of it, it's a possibility.
So much of this had been haphazard in the way it'd been investigated, particularly those early Portuguese investigations, that actually Madeleine McCann deserved a proper police investigation, and they hadn't had one up to that stage.
Yeah. It would seem to me that in terms of the investigation, if you're talking about the circles of people who have access to the children other than the parents and immediate vacationers, would be those kids club people who had access to the kids, watching the parents come and go, watching their habits, probably hearing them talk about their plans for the evening. Those workers are right there and to the point where they're signing them out, which is not, that's not that unusual when to have a childcare worker sign out. It's just like the mom is picking them up at the gate and doesn't have time to walk all the way to sign the little, the clipboard. So the childcare worker like waves and signs them out for them. That's not unusual.
Right.
In my experience, but that would seem to be like the perfect place for somebody who's got some kind of predatory intentions or is part of an organized group who are looking for victims, who are looking for kids that they might prey upon. That would be the perfect place to observe. And they know that campus or they know the resort, they know how those
apartments are probably very similar. All those apartments are similar to each other. And how much did investigators spotlight those workers?
Well, we know that certainly from the reports by the Portuguese police were that they had 300 officers working within 24 hours. They had 443 doors knocked on, 700 people that they interviewed. And they talked to the employees of the resort as well, 112 of them. But to answer your question, and maybe Jim knows, I didn't hear anything specifically about the kids club employees. And of course, you would want to look at immediately those who all had contact or access with Maddie. And you would also want to know, are any of them transient, i.e., you know, who's new, who's been moving around? Is there somebody that hasn't worked there before? Because some of those jobs are very transient. And therefore, you would want to clear the ground under your feet on that one. But of course, if you've given the right name of who you are, then you are traceable and trackable. And you would expect, and I'm not going to say that this happened because it may not have, but a company like Mark Warner, you would expect them to have done background checks on those in particular who are coming into contact with children. And those CRB checks are really important, but whether
you would hope
done is another question, right, Jim?
Right. Yeah. You would hope that would happen. I think the chances that there's somebody working in that field who is sexually attracted to children are extremely high. Any target-rich environment like that, any environment in which children are brought to any place, a sport, a school, an organization, a location, a resort, a pool, a beach, anything that children would be attracted to also by nature attracts offenders who are sexually interested in children. And so I would have scrutinized them incredibly closely because that could have been a very high risk environment. We think that it would have been more safe for McCanns to drop Madeline and the kids off to the creche, but that creche could be exactly where the greatest risk was. So the realities are the people that we trust with our children are the most likely to actually take advantage of our children. And so I am not impressed by their lack of really deep diving into that. I do think, though, it was 300 cops weren't around till 48 hours later. But the fact is, they did.
So I can only go by what I heard, and it was 24 hours. They had 300, but 130 officers, came in first of all, and then 300. But again, different accounts from different people.
Right. And the count I heard was 130 in the first 24, 300 in the first 48. But even that, when you talk about that many resources, we in the Behavioral Analysis Unit of the FBI suggest that that happens in the first hour, not the first 2 days. And it's critically important that everybody understand that if a child is actually abducted by a stranger, that the mortality rate is very high. It's 2/3 of those kids end up getting killed in long-term stranger abductions. And that means that you have to respond immediately and overwhelmingly. You cannot take it lightly and treat it as if the kid has just wandered off. If the kid just wandered off and you put out a lot of resources to try to find that kid, they may be resources wasted. But if you don't do it, that would be life that you're risking. And so we want to protect our most vulnerable children. And clearly, Maddie, for whatever reason, was one of those vulnerable children.
Right. We used to say at New Scotland Yard, two mantras. You clear the ground from under your feet, but you also scale up to start with. And when you scale up to start with, then you can reduce. But if you do it the other way around, that's when you get into trouble because you miss those golden opportunities and you will never get them back. And therefore, you can never clear the ground from under your feet. And those question marks about abandoned wells, reservoirs, lakes, you know, open bodies of water in that were particular to that area. We can't say confidently that she wasn't in any of those places. So you never get that time back. And that's why they call it the golden hours. But of course, they treated it, missing person investigation was not a criminal investigation. And I don't know if that's changed in Portugal since. That would be interesting to know. Certainly, we treat investigations, missing person investigations, very differently, and they get triaged and assessed as to which are your critical cases, and they get the resources.
So the reason why you have to treat it as though it's a criminal case, first of all, the police are the ones that have to do the searching. The police are the ones that can get access to all these homes and cars and sheds and whatever they need access to. The police have that authority. And unless they use it, then this child, what they're doing is they're risking the death of whoever gets abducted. And we know at about the same time, a small boy also went missing in that same area, and he didn't get any of that same kind of attention or that same kind of police response. And nothing's ever been found about him. So it's just, it's really important that police respond to all missing kids, immediately determine whether or not that child has been taken or wandered off or is at risk, and start the process of investigating it as if it was a stranger abduction so that they can maximize the chances of bringing that child back alive.
And also, can't one case unlock another? I mean, if you treat them all, you know, with the equal amount of attention they all deserve, you never know if Maddie was abducted. This was not the predator's first go or last go. So
it happened in the Ben Ollenby investigation. Sean Hornbeck was discovered. I mean, as well as Ben Ollenby, and that was an amazing find. But people just don't understand that if you are a sex offender who is sexually interested in children, and if you're successful in abducting one child, of course, you might do it again and again and again. And these are serial offenders mainly because this is the way they can get access to kids. And unfortunately, they'll never stop.
And linkage is so important. You know, looking at what was going on prior, to look at other antecedent crimes. You may have some near misses, you may have some bungled cases. And we saw one of those on the Netflix documentary, which was a terrifying reconstruction of the mum coming downstairs and seeing a man in her house. And another account by Anthony Summers that there were two children lying in bed, and a man with a surgical mask went in and lay down next to the youngest child. You know, and these antecedents are exactly what my unit, the Homicide Prevention Unit, and as a criminal behavioural analyst, that's exactly what we were charged with. In the Amélie Delagrange case that led to the arrest of Levi Belfield, you want to find those other cases. So it's a major problem, and it can be a needle in a haystack, but these cases are very rare. And of course, you know, a grown man going into an apartment or into a villa and being sighted, sometimes, well, that's not reported. And with Millie Dowler, which is a very high-profile case, before Millie went missing, a young girl in school uniform was approached by a man in a car with two child seats in the back. Now, he wanted her to get in the car and was saying that he was her new neighbour. She felt something was off about him, and she basically saw a police car on the other side of the road. He looked in the same direction, saw the police car, and he drove off. Frightened. Now, that, I believe, was a near miss in that situation. Yeah. That was days before Millie Dowler went missing. Now, that wasn't reported initially. And then when it was, the police said, well, nothing really happened and it wasn't prioritized. But that was a missed opportunity where potentially an offender could have been arrested and Millie may not have then been abducted. And we do believe that was precursor to Millie, and that was Levi Belfield. And there were lots of opportunities to intervene at an earlier stage. And that's what my unit, the Homicide Prevention Unit at New Scotland Yard, spent a lot of time looking at these cases and profiling them backwards as well, not only helping in category A investigations, which is what this would be called, an A+, but also looking at where those windows of opportunity were to get better at what we did. And linkage analysis is absolutely vital, and therefore appealing to the public is a key part. Did something happen? Please tell us if it did. We're seeking X, Y, and Z. You can put the types of offences that you're interested in hearing about out there, but you also have to search your intelligence databases and your police databases as well. And you want officers calling you, telling you about a potential abduction that they attended. But we don't know any of that was done at early stages.
I was shocked, first and foremost, when the McCanns weren't immediately, under the Portuguese system, considered suspects. That was the first a critical mistake. It was unfair for the investigators, unfair with regards to the integrity of the forensic evidence that would be captured, and unfair to the McCanns themselves. Clear the ground beneath your feet, first and foremost.
Right. I think the reports of these men collecting for an orphanage that nobody was able to verify, and this guy that was fixated on the daughter and then the next day showed up and actually had entered the home and was with the daughter and then ran when the mother came down. I think those are very, very serious incidents. And I don't know that they were treated as serious incidents. They're very, very risky behavior. They're events that it looked like somebody's trying to get access. Now, whether the guys who were claiming they're raising for an orphanage are just there to steal money, that's one thing. But this guy who came and actually entered the house the next day when the mother was upstairs, that's extremely high-risk behavior. And when you're doing something that's such a high-risk behavior, your goals are usually very risky, very extreme. And so I think that was an attempted abduction. I think that was something that could have ended in that child being abducted and killed. And if that same man was around the resort in Praia da Luz, then that same man could have been somebody that could have abducted Maddie McCann.
So that's really interesting, Jim. And of course, these other offenses came to light quite a long time after Madeline's disappearance, which again is a major problem. You would want to be hearing about these straight away. Certainly DCI Andy Redwood, when he took over Operation Grange, or when he launched it, he went on to Crime Watch in 2013 and was appealing for these types of offences, or for if people knew or were at Praia da Luz at this resort at that time, he wanted people to come forward. And one of the key aspects of Operation Grange, when they launched it, they said, well, we've had significant people come forward and we can now rule out the Jane Tanner sighting, the man carrying the child, as being someone who was staying at the Ocean Club and he had similar clothes, and therefore that line of inquiry is closed. But the problem is that if you spend too much time and you get an epistemic imbalance just focusing on that one line of inquiry, it means you've missed all the others and you're not looking at every other aspect. So
right.
Close them down to think about who are we appealing to locally. And I'm not sure, I don't know whether Kathy told you or whether you have that inside knowledge, but were there ever any appeals or any searches done for similar types of crimes or young girls at the time, or was this all done retrospectively?
Well, I don't know if it was done at the time because she was not called in immediately. It was months later. But I know what she did was she brought our child abduction response plan to Praia da Luz and gave it to the Portuguese. And we in there have questionnaires, for example, that are meant to be used on every door knock in the neighborhood. And of course, one of the questions is, has there been any suspicious behavior? Has there been anybody in the neighborhood that you noticed? Do you know if anybody, have you heard of anybody else doing this kind of behavior? So those things are part of what law enforcement officers are trained to do in this case. I don't know how trained this particular police force was in that area. It doesn't seem like they were following those kinds of recommendations. And when you mentioned about Jane Tanner's sighting being explained, it does another thing as well. And it actually gives credibility to Jane Tanner's sighting. In other words, people are saying, well, she added it later. And that could mean that, well, maybe she made it up. And it was made up deliberately to try to throw off the investigation. But in fact, when it was ruled out as being an abductor, it actually gave credibility to her and her statement because there was a man carrying a child at that time, at that place. So even though he wasn't abducting Maddie, what it means is that her statements have an added bit of credibility because it was verified.
Right. And, you know, there's still so much more that we need to discuss, because we keep going back to, well, what is the crime? You know, what was the crime that was committed? And therefore, when you understand the what, you can start to think about the who you're looking for. And, mm-hmm. you know, we know that they were very myopic, the Portuguese police, and I believe New Scotland Yard as well, very myopic and very narrow in their focus. And that's what really bothers me about this case, this narrowing. So perhaps we can get into, you know, the other hypotheses. And when we do think about Operation Grange, we have to remember that, unlike what DCI Andy Redwood said on Crime Watch, and I'd invite our listeners to watch Crime Watch because it is available online, he said that they would leave no stone unturned, that this would be a reinvestigation. They would go right back to the beginning. But that is not what happened. They did not go right back to the beginning. Right. It would involve interviewing everybody. And therefore, we have to be clear and open and transparent about what was done, by whom, and at what stage. Because there is an imbalance here, and people have been very narrow in their focus. And that can happen for lots of different reasons. So I think it would be really great if we can get into that in the next episode.
Great.
Before we go, I just want to say that I know that most childcare workers are loving, caring, responsible, and trustworthy people who have a really hard job and are usually paid a very low wage. So I in no way want to malign that career or the people who work in it.
Of course not.
Yeah, just wanted to make that clear.
But we have to be ever vigilant, because the people who are sexually attracted to children are attracted to those professions as well. And in order to protect your children, you have to be ever vigilant about the qualifications and the reasons and the attention that those people pay to your children. And you need to have conversations with your children, conversations back and forth. Your children have to be able to talk to you about sexual Your children have to be able to talk to you about sexual activity. You have to educate them so that they can discuss with you the potential of grooming and sexual victimization. And that's a way you can help protect your own children.
Sure.
And that's also in all professions. And it's a good point. But I remember with the Holly Wells and Jessica Chapman case, which is a very high profile case in the UK. And it turned out that one of the family liaison officers had child sexual abuse images on his computer. And therefore, people do go into different jobs, you know, occupations, professions, hobbies to access, you know, sometimes under the cloak of legitimacy. And that's exactly Jim's point. So it's not maligning. It's just opening people's eyes to the fact that you may think you're safe in a secure, in inverted commas, you know, Mark Warner holiday. But you've always got to be questioning of people who want more access to your children or people who are around you. And it just serves you much better to be vigilant and have your eyes wide open. But it's certainly not to malign, you know, those who are there for all the right reasons, but people, predators, in inverted commas, hide in plain sight. And they're the ones who tend to have a long track record of getting away with it and tend to be plausible to the rest of the world. So we've still got a lot more to discuss. And as I always say, if you do have information about Madeleine McCann in the UK, on the 12th year anniversary of her disappearance, please do contact Operation Grange. It is a live, ongoing investigation, and you can call them on 0207 321 9251 or email operation.grange@met.pnn.police.uk or the PJ in Portugal, +351 282 405 400, or you can email dic.portomeo@pj.pt, and we'll put any links within our show notes. So for now, thank you for listening. This is Real Crime Profile signing out. If you like our podcasts, there are a few things you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotions and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go to Facebook and like our Facebook page, and you can also follow us on Twitter at Real Crime Profile without the E. And one last thing, please tell your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate all of our listeners.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214 946 4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.